Hola y bienvenidos a RDF Outlook, el podcast donde platicaremos con abogados y visionarios sobre tecnología, consejos y el futuro de la industria. Soy Pepe Toriello y estoy convencido que los abogados podemos trabajar mejor y más rápido con los softwares correctos. Este podcast es una prueba.
All right. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. My name is Mark Doucette, and I have my co-host, Pepe Toriello, with us. We are going to be starting a series about contract management. Hopefully, we'll be having a bunch of guests on the show, but this is going to be our first one. We'll be talking about legal tech, procurement, contract generation, CCLM, and many other topics. Our first guest today is going to be Dennis Potakum. I'm still working on that last name. And he is going to do a quick introduction. First, I'm going to turn things over to Pepe. He can tell you a little bit about himself before we dive in here. And then we'll give things over to Dennis.
So, hey, guy. Thanks, Mark. I'm Pepe Toriello, and I'm a Mexico lawyer. We have a consulting firm here in Mexico City. So, and we focus on legal tech consulting and also marketing consulting. And it's a pleasure to have you guys here in the show. Yes, of course, it's a new show, the podcast. And Dennis, thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah, very happy to be here. And by the way, I'm used to my surname being pronounced and mispronounced in all sorts of ways. So no worries at all. I'm happy to be on first name terms anyway. So shall I say a little bit of an introduction about myself?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm Dennis Potemkin, and I'm a consultant on focusing at the moment on contracting and contract improvement. So my big thing at the moment is better contracts, and that basically ranges from contract content and design through to using technology to work with contracts better. My background, I have both a private practice and an in-house background. For the last 10 years, I've been at Global 250 companies as a commercial intellectual property and technology lawyer. In the last couple of years, I've gone independent, and I've been helping companies do some of these things better that people struggle with all the time, especially around contracts. And at the same time, I'm doing some work myself on a contract automation product called Majoto. So very early stage, but trying to again find a new way of fixing some of these problems that we know we all have and struggle with. So a bit of talking and a lot of doing as well.
Perfect. Excellent. Thanks, Dennis. We appreciate you giving us an overview. Why don't we go ahead and hop in, right, guys? So the theme today is going to be adding contract redesign to your contract lifecycle management projects. It's a big buzzword out there, right? A lot of companies are focusing on transitioning from Excel and Outlook into a contract lifecycle management tool to help manage those contracts. But today we're going to be focusing on actual contract redesign to make things simpler and easier throughout the organization. So Dennis, I know that you had a couple of things that we wanted to talk about, right? In the first one being, we all understand that contracts are a way of getting a business from point A to point B, they should be easier to digest for other parts of the organization besides legal. Can you give us just a little bit of a background on how companies right now are currently doing that? And maybe we can kind of segue from there into some tips and tricks that you have to make this a little bit of an easier topic and focus for organizations to talk about.
Sure thing. And look, I think that analogy is fantastic. I think, contracts it's a tool. It's a business tool, or at least it's meant to be. If it works, it's meant to be a good business tool for getting business outcomes, right? And I think the content of the contracts and the way they're designed, how digestible they are, and other aspects are absolutely a critical piece. Not just the technology that you're applying to automate. And so the analogy, I'd like to kind of expand on that analogy a little bit further. So if you think about contract as a means from getting from A to B, and the way that it was done traditionally back in the day before computers and all that kind of stuff, it was in writing, right? And things were mm-hmm. then transferred by horse, right? So I sometimes think about contracts, at least the traditional way of doing it, as the horse that gets you from A to B. Mm-hmm. Now, it can get you from A to B, but it's not necessarily the fastest or the most efficient or, frankly, the cleanest way of doing that. And what we're seeing is that the way that most companies and most people are still doing contracts is they're still using the horse. What do I mean by that? They're still using Word and email as you know, Word to create and draft these contracts, and email to basically negotiate them. So, you know, you'll draft your contract, you'll in Word, you'll send it by email, and then you'll sort of exchange markups with track changes until you get somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that's terrible, because I think that is such an inefficient and old-fashioned way of doing it. And it's just unfortunate that these tools, Word and email, much as they are great tools, have become kind of ubiquitous in the legal space and are being used for contracts in a way that I think is really not the right use. It's not the right tools and not the right way to use them. Mm-hmm.
They're using tools with the same tools since Windows 95.
Well, this is it. This is it. It's amazing. You know, in this day and age, when you've got so many new technologies and indeed, you know, collaborative technologies, people are still defaulting to those old tools.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that legal is kind of lagging behind other departments when it comes to, you know, making that automation transition into using tools that are available to them? You know, we see sales and marketing are two of the leaders of that pack, right? They love to always transition into new tools. But why do we think that legal is kind of lagging behind that?
No, I think, you know, legal has lagged behind in tech generally. Mm-hmm. I think the profession as a whole, there is a certain conservatism in the profession as a whole. I think it's just a fundamental thing. Now, you know, I know a lot of really creative, innovative, technology savvy lawyers, and you see firms, large firms and boutique firms starting to get, doing some pretty amazing stuff. But as a whole, you know, it is a relatively conservative profession. I think also it's a profession that's sort of treated, and it's not the only profession to have done this, but has seen itself as a bit exceptional. So we don't necessarily have to follow what everyone else is doing because our area is special because we're mm-hmm. in the law. Mm-hmm. And I think that's at least part of the problem. But, you know, it's a profession that's starting to move and it will change. We're seeing a huge amount of change now, and that change will, I think, really transform the profession over the next 5-10 years. But I think the other issue is just habit, right? I mean, we all know that we do things that are inefficient just because of inertia. That's the habit. And I really think that in the, you know, email is a great tool, but how many of us abuse it, right? We use it to communicate instead of picking up the phone or getting meetings. Way too much. You know, we've got clogged inboxes. So whereas email used to be the way to connect instantaneously, now it's a thing where you can, you know, something can sit in people's inboxes for weeks before a response comes through. So, you know, in the instantaneous forms of communication have moved to other channels. I'd give you another sort of fundamental example of that kind of conservatism and bad habits. And it goes directly to this point around contract content. If you think how lawyers draft contracts, right? You know, no lawyer is going to sit and draft a contract from scratch. They're going to take whatever precedents or previous examples they've had, and they're going to kind of take a few of these, and they're going to kind of put it together. They're going to Frankenstein it. They're going to copy and paste, and they'll produce a first draft of a new contract. And what that process, and in some ways that's a reasonably efficient process, mm-hmm. but again, it's being kind of, it gets abused, because what happens is that lawyers just start copying, pasting, you know, old precedents, and it kind of gets perpetuated. So basically over generations, you know, people are using the same old bad language and layering even more bad language on top of it. And mm-hmm. it just gets perpetuated and perpetuated. And I think that's one of the big reasons why fundamentally the language of contracts hasn't really updated itself, for several decades. It's not fundamentally different. And that's why at the moment it is so terribly archaic, long-winded and complicated. I mean, just, you know, there was an IACCM study, I think a couple of years ago, that suggested that 88% of people don't actually understand the contracts that they work with. And, you know, considering that contracts are really a lifeblood of commerce, I think that's an appalling bit of statistic.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that. And so, Dennis, and how have you helped these companies? Like, can you give us some examples of how contract design helps automation?
Yes, of course. Now, so let me just kind of just stepping back. I think, if you think about this, there's kind of three fundamental problems, I think, in terms of how the contracts are done. So it's the old tools that we touched on. It's old processes, which is basically, you know, most of the processes around contracts and indeed, in some extent, contract automation is based on sort of it's supplier driven and kind of driven by legal needs as opposed to the business needs, the customer's needs, right? It's driven very much by risk rather than outcome. So lawyers are really good at sort of thinking about risk and controlling risk. That's really how lawyers are taught. I don't think lawyers are as naturally good at thinking about outcomes. I mean, that's what the business kind of focuses on, right? So that's the other thing. And then the final sort of problem is this kind of unresolved conflict that I think exists, which kind of closely relates to the previous two problems, but it's that conflict between the lawyers as kind of controllers of risks, as the guardians of risk, and business as the guardians of outcomes. So the business just want to get stuff done, and the lawyer says, no, hold on a second, let's manage the risks. And I think that conflict is very much present, whether it's small companies or large companies, and that's never really been quite resolved. So, you know, now lawyers think, you know, good lawyers think a lot more about, well, what is the business outcome? But that process hasn't been fully resolved. And the problem is that tools that are being used, so Word, email, it only perpetuates those three problems. It doesn't help to solve them. So when I try and help companies manage their contracts better, I look at all of these aspects. So it means looking, okay, what are the tools that you're using and can you use better tools? Mm-hmm. And obviously contract automation products is one of the possible kind of things that you can look at. Mm-hmm. Then you look at kind of the processes. So your processes too supplier focused. You want to be thinking more about the business and how they work and what they want and how to drive outcomes. And I guess third is, you know, how do you set up your kind of process and communication in a way that actually helps the business achieve what they need to achieve within certain controls and frameworks? And how do we get lawyers, you know, focusing on kind of strategic stuff and focusing on outcomes instead of just sort of churning out kind of, you know, churning on risk all the time? So I think a holistic kind of a holistic improvement on contract process has to look at all these aspects. But I can sort of give you, I think in terms of tools, that's kind of technology. So let's just maybe leave that till a little bit later. But, you know, so if I think about how do we help companies do contracts better, it is basically around content. So what is the content of your contracts? Is it simple? Is it readable? Is it plain language? Is it up to date? Is it clear? Because unfortunately, a lot of this legalese is actually not clear at all. When people layer on this kind of bad language on top of bad language, it doesn't help to manage risk. It actually makes it worse. For those listeners who are interested in this, check out Ken Adams. So Ken Adams, and perhaps at the end of this podcast, we can provide some links here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ken Adams has studied contract language to a really deep extent, and he's sort of analyzed it and shown that a lot of the time, this kind of common forms of language are not of legal language and contracts doesn't actually add to clarity; it only adds to uncertainty. I think An example is a thing called word strings. So you may be familiar you've seen lots of contracts. You know, you will see that there'll be something like, I don't know, party A covenants, agrees, warrants, and represents that such and such is true, right? Yeah. Or party A transfers, assigns, sells, conveys, and hands over, such and such asset. So lawyers love this. It's words that kind of mean the same thing, mm-hmm. but they kind of layer it like three or four or five of this, basically trying to say the same thing in lots of ways. And they do it because it's like a safety net. Well, that way I capture everything. And Ken is fantastic because he's shown how these word strings actually completely mess up the whole meaning of what you're trying to do and mm-hmm. create uncertainty. And is not a good way of drafting contracts. So that's what I mean kind of around sort of one of the things I mean around content and clarity. And then content goes deeper than that because when you look at content, you've also got to think about, well, how much does my contract focus on risk versus outcomes, right? So studies have shown that, most contracts get kind of stuck and negotiated on quite a small number of clauses, like liability clauses, exclusions of yes. liability, liability caps, and all that kind of stuff. And this is all kind of risk stuff, right? It also relates to risk. It's usually related to really, really unlikely contingencies, right? That may have a big impact, but they're really unlikely contingencies. And when you negotiate and when your contract focuses on those issues more than getting the deal done and what is the deal all about and, what are the two parties, trying to get to, mm-hmm. then you end up focusing a lot of your discussions and negotiations on that risk stuff. And that's inefficient. It sort of destroys trust. It sort of doesn't help to build relationships. And in the end, you're spending all this effort and resource on contingencies. You're not spending your effort and resource on the stuff that really, really matters, which is getting a collaboration going and getting commercial results. So getting that balance right between the outcome and the risk is another key aspect that I think a significant proportion of contracts fail to do well. So that's content. And then you get into sort of more kind of even more exciting stuff in my view, which is around what I call design. Now, mm-hmm. by design, I don't mean sort of putting pictures in and that kind of thing. I'm talking about, well, how is the contract structured in a way that makes it work better and lets users work with it more efficiently. So again, if you've got a contract that's full of long paragraphs, all kind of homogenous, 50 pages of big blocks of text, even the lawyers will find it hard to work with. So the process of drafting it, aligning it on internally and negotiating it becomes really, really long-winded and cumbersome, and the business guys don't understand anything, right? Mm-hmm. So contract design is all about, well, how do I change that? How do I, aside from simplifying the language, change the structure of a contract to make it easier to work with? So one fantastic example is, put the business stuff at the beginning. Most contracts put the big business stuff, the key commercials, right at the end. It is hidden away in technical and commercial schedules. That's nuts, right? So put it at the beginning. A key technique is to put all the business terms, the key commercial terms at the beginning of a contract, even if it's just a summary and then you deep dive in it later. But you put this key stuff right at the beginning and then the business knows what you're trying to negotiate and all the other boring stuff is for the lawyers. And that's a tried and tested and a fantastic kind of productivity technique to make your contracts work better. And there's a ton of other things like that. This year I started a series on LinkedIn, so a series of articles which I'm posting on LinkedIn, which is mm-hmm. really looking at this point. So how do you what can you do with content and design to make your contracts more productive? So if listeners are interested in this, follow that, because I've been putting up and will continue to put up some really, really practical examples of what you can do to turn your contract into something really useful, not just reams of archaic blocks mm-hmm. of text.
And we can definitely add a link into that in the show notes as well. And Dennis, let me ask you this. So in your experience, have you worked with organizations that were implementing a contract management solution while going about, you know, working on the language of these contracts as well as the structure of them, do you recommend that maybe they try to tackle that first before looking at contract management solutions, or is that something that they can kind of do all at once?
Look, I think that's going to depend, right? That's going to depend on the circumstances and how much resource you've got to throw at it. Mm-hmm. I say, look, you've got to at least think about your kind of content design and process before making any final decisions on the tech, right? Because that helps you make the right decision on the kind of technology to use, and also how you're actually going to use it. You know, how you're going to prioritize it, how you're going to sequence it, what functions are going to start using it first, and you know, how much control do you give to business versus lawyers? You know, do you use the technology to enable self-serve by the business or not? All those kind of decisions, I think, can only be made correctly if you address this issue kind of upfront. Now, I think you can do it as part of a technology project. Mm-hmm. But then you've got to make sure you've made some good choices on the technology side, and then you need the resource to be able to tackle it, right? Because unless you've got already very, very kind of orderly templates and good language, or you've made a conscious choice that I'm not going to touch that for whatever reason, and if there's inefficiencies that result from it, I'm just going to suck it up. Mm-hmm. Unless you've done that, you know, you really want to be kind of approaching it in a holistic way, as opposed to kind of, you know, going halfway through implementing the technology and then finding that actually, you know, you're uploading your templates and you're trying to automate them and put in fields, let's say, and put in options, and suddenly you're realizing, wait, this is getting too complicated because our templates are in a mess. And I've seen this happen, and I've heard of that sort of thing happen. So I do think, you know, thinking about it holistically is really important. And in some circumstances, you may well say, look, let's as part of this project, make sure we get a few things sorted out in terms of content design and simplify things, rationalize things before we get too far down the tech implementation stage. But I think the key is to look at this holistically.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think that makes complete sense. Pepe, did you have another question for Dennis?
Yes, actually. So we were talking about all how we lawyers love to create long contracts, especially, and you said it right, Dennis. It just creates a huge mess because not even lawyers can understand the clauses right away. You have to reread them 2, 3, 4 times sometimes. And but the thing is that lawyers usually do this because they think that they have to cover all the risks that can arise from that activity that they just want to place on the clause. But in your experience, like if you simplify and shorten contracts, you know, like people, especially lawyers, might be worried that they are less robust and they create risk. Like, how do you answer this concern? How do you make them feel more comfortable that if you create a leaner contract, it will be like not just easier for reading, but it will also cover all these risks?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, you know, if you look at a person and you look at a person who's lean and does exercise, you know, that person is going to be healthier and stronger than a person who's not healthy, doesn't lead a healthy lifestyle, right? I mean, it's these things are obvious. And I think it's the same with contracts. I mean, a contract that is lean is by definition going to be more certain, right? It may not have all this kind of you know, kind of belt and braces kind of risk stuff. But if it's well drafted, it covers the risks, right? But the point is that all this belt and braces and kind of saying things lots of different times in really complicated ways, it usually leads to uncertainty. And uncertainty is the last thing that you want with contracts. Contracts are designed to create certainty, to give both sides certainty of what they're doing and what happens. You know, so the kind of the examples, you know, and you don't even, you know, you don't have to agree with everything that, you know, the likes of Ken Adams and other sort of advocates of plain language say, and you're going to make the right decisions based on your own kind of risk appetite, your own approach, and you know what you think is works in your industry. But yeah, in my experience, so I've gone through exercises where we have reduced the length of contracts by half. Mm-hmm. So they're 50% the length that they used to be, without reducing anything, any of the protections or risk management. And I believe that your average contract can be reduced by up to 50% just through lean drafting, without impacting it negatively at all.
And how are other legal teams that you're working with, you know, on the other side of things, how are they taking this kind of proactive approach that you are taking? Do they have any feedback for you, or do they see any worries? Are you trying to combat what they're doing on the other side of things because you are, you know, taking this new approach that maybe they haven't seen before?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think when you're doing this sort of stuff, I mean, this is never something that one person can do in isolation, right? Mm-hmm. So when I'm doing this work as a consultant, this is always very working closely with the client in a way that, you know, the client doesn't, it's very light touch for the client because the heavy lifting is being done by the consultant, but right. You've got to, understand what are you trying to do? What are the priorities? What are the objectives? Kind of from the beginning, and then you've got to get that kind of, you need to get the feedback because they know the industry in a way that you may not. They know how the company works. They know how some other stakeholders look at this. So, you know, you've got to make sure that there is alignment with stakeholders. Well, look, I'll give you, some lawyers are kind of more and less conservative. So you've got to kind of, I think there's an element of responding to what people want, but also kind of educating and bringing people on board. I mean, a recent project that I did was really interesting and enlightening because one of the lawyers from the client, as when we released the new template, and she was sort of using it for the first time, she said to me, "Look, I've been reading through this, and every time I think, well, hold on, it's too short. Something must have been missed out. But when I looked at it, there was nothing missing." So she had that kind of sense, well, how can it be so short? But there was never anything missing. And that's the beauty of lean drafting. I've had estimates in terms of my experience, in terms of what people have said with this sort of approach, you know, you can have quite a big impact. You can reduce the amount of time and effort spent on contracts by, you know, 30, 40, 50 percent, maybe even higher. It depends on, you know, where you, what your starting point is and how sort of progressive you've been and a whole load of other things. But I do believe that you can get some significant gains in terms of, you know, the speed at which you draft it, the speed at which you negotiate it. So I think, look, I mean, again, people have different levels of sort of exposure to this, to this way of thinking. Around kind of lean drafting and design. There's a growing community. You'll find people who are very, very strong advocates of this. And you'll find a large majority that are perhaps just, you know, don't have the time or the awareness to practice it. But there are some fantastic examples also. I mean, I always call out this example, and that's Lemonade. So Lemonade is an insurance, online insurance provider. They issued an open source insurance policy. And their insurance policy, I think, is a brilliant example of kind of design in action when it comes to contracts, because it's like, it's super casual. It's written in this very, very consumer friendly way. There are no pictures, but it's just a joy to read, because it's just written in such a smart and clever way, and it's short and it's simple and it's easier to understand. And this is an insurance policy, right? I mean, that's where you really get to manage the risk. So if they manage to do this, and I'd encourage encourage all of you guys who are listening to take a look at this, because if they can do it with an insurance policy, you can do it with any contract.
And have you seen any different kind of resistance between lawyers that work at the law firms and lawyers that work inside companies regarding the contract design? Because as you tell, like, it depends on the exposure. And I would say, like, in-house lawyers will think more about the efficiency, how contracts are designed, so the rest of the departments of the company can understand
its content. But on the other side, law firms, they're usually drafting contracts for their clients, and they don't want to be in the middle of a problem because they didn't draft or they didn't insert something that was very important on the risk on the contract. Like, have you seen any kind of resistance from lawyers that work in law firms from this new approach on contract design?
I'm not sure. I mean, I wouldn't use the word resistance, because I think when people really understand it, I think it's actually hard to resist. I think the bigger issue is a lack of awareness. Especially lack of awareness of what it truly is. And it is, in some ways, you know, kind of legal design, I think among some, probably some sectors of the law is seen kind of negatively, because they see it, it's all about putting pretty pictures and, on a contract, which is not what it is. And, you know, there are some bad examples of it where people have taken just bad text and stuck a few icons and say, hey, this is legal design. But those are appalling examples, and that's not what it's all about. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to say, honestly. I mean, I think with law firms, I mean, law firms are a bit of a machine. You know, they're sort of designed in a certain way to churn out this kind of content, and they've got all their precedent banks. And so I think for a law firm to really change fundamentally, I think that's going to take time. I've seen some among companies, there's been some really sort of pioneering companies that have been doing stuff around this. And have been sort of have teams who have been experimenting and are responsible for trying to find new ways of kind of presenting, visualizing, designing contracts. But I think that's a handful. I think for the majority of businesses, it's kind of business as usual, and they just don't have. I think as an in-house lawyer, you just don't have the time for anything that's not essential. So I think it's a job of, how do you say, this kind of the growing community of people who are really, you know, kind of passionate and enthusiastic and knowledgeable about the space to kind of really spread the word, you know, show people how to do it, that it, you know, anyone can sort of with some guidance and tools which are actually freely available can start playing around with this and experimenting and doing something different. So I think this kind of needs to be changed kind of really at grassroots level, and that's going to take a bit of time, but I think spreading the word and giving people examples is important. And I think the other thing that's really important is for those companies who are experimenting to actually stop experimenting and actually embed it. Because you see a lot of examples, like, you know, we've done a workshop and we've created a visual NDA. Great, another visual NDA. I love visual NDAs, but come on, let's, you know, show me a procurement agreement done in this with the same style, right? Let's get these, you know, show us that you're actually really, really changing how you're doing these contracts, and not just the kind of the simple stuff that doesn't need to be negotiated. Let's start really, really forcing this on people, and rather than just experimenting at the edges. That's kind of a sort of a frustration I feel. But, you know, I found with clients that I'm working with, even those who are, you know, don't want to do anything too fancy, that they are open to doing things in a new way, you know, step by step. And I think it's going to start changing.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I know, Pepe, I know you and Dennis could probably talk about this forever, right? we're definitely trying to keep these to around 30 minutes. I think that we're actually coming up on that. So Dennis, let's go ahead and end this maybe with what are a couple quick action items that people should take away from this? How can they go about starting this implementation within their organization?
Right. Okay. So I think the first point is to have to understand what your kind of purpose is. So I always think about this framework, technology, and process. Right. There's kind of this triangle of network that we're all familiar with. And I say, you know, that's all great, but you've got to figure out what your objectives are. So I like thinking about purpose. So, you know, start thinking about what do you want to do? Do you want to sort of make things more efficient? Do you want to be a thought leader in this stuff? So just try and understand what are you trying to do with an exercise like this. So I think that's important to start off with, because then all the decisions you make afterwards are really guided by that kind of North Star. I think the other the practical thing to start doing is to kind of understand where you are, right? To get some sort of picture of how does your process operate currently, how mature you are, you know. So take a look at how many templates you've got, and if you find that you've got 30 templates for a procurement contract, something's wrong, right? have a look at maybe sort of think about how long are your contracts, prioritize them. What are the contracts that are most relevant for the business, and let's look at those first, as opposed to necessarily taking the contract that's the easiest and the least relevant, right? So a bit of an exercise around that. There are some interesting maturity models out there that you can use. So Radiant Law has a maturity sort of test that you can do around your contracting process. So you could sort of apply something like that, just to kind of understand where you are, and then understand, broadly, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? Do you just want to experiment at this stage, or do you have some particular targets around reducing the time taken on contracts? So having some understanding of where you're going, so you know where you are, where do you want to go, is important. I think in time, what you really want to be doing is building up a roadmap of where you want to be over a period of years, so that you keep yourself honest and keep doing this. I think the next step is really get a workshop together with key stakeholders and talk about what are the problems, what are people saying about your contracts and your contract process, mm-hmm. What needs to be different, and have a structured way of looking at the problem, and what you want to be doing about it. And that's going to be, and I think getting those stakeholders on board from the beginning is absolutely crucial, right? Because no one's kind of, legal is never doing this in isolation, and procurement is never doing this in isolation. There's right. different functions involved, so you got to get on the same page and say, okay, we're going to do something about this. And I think and you sort of take it from there. I think what's really, really important is the following. I mean, there's a lot of companies, especially if you think about in-house lawyers, everyone's really busy. Finding the time to do this is difficult. But also what I've seen a lot is companies sort of bumble along on this. They don't have a clear plan. And there's a lot of reinventing of the wheel. And there are people out there who've done it before, who are putting out resources on the net, who are putting mm-hmm. out resources on LinkedIn, who are able to sort of give you some advice and help out. So this doesn't mean that, to do it well, you've got to engage a consultant and pay a ton of money for them to do it for you. But it is important to get someone who's done it before and has some expertise to kind of give you some guidance and mentoring on this. And that's a recommendation I'd make to any sort of in-house lawyers, legal departments who are, or indeed lawyers who are looking at this issue, looking at this and wanting to experiment, is get some guidance on this, because there's a lot of knowledge out there and people willing to impart some knowledge and who are really passionate about getting that change on the ground. And I think that's going to make a huge difference to what you end up doing and how you progress.
Great. Great. Awesome. No, I think that's definitely provides a little bit more insight, especially for me, being in sales. I know that you guys in legal probably talk about this a lot more than we do, but it's definitely something that we can all get behind. And I think we all can agree that simplifying contract management is definitely something that it needs to take place in organizations. So Dennis, we really appreciate you, spending some time with us. If anybody wants to learn a little bit more about what you do or your organization, where can they find you? What's the best way to reach you?
So they can find me through my website, which is potemkin.legal. So again, we can provide a link.
Yep.
They can contact me through that. That's or just connect with me on LinkedIn.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Pepe, anything to add?
So I really enjoy this, and so I really hope that our next guests are as incredible as this podcast. We learn a lot, and I really think that there's a lot of people that will be really interesting. So thanks a lot, Dennis. It was super interesting, and we really hope to hopefully do this again.
All right.
I'd love to do it
again. Thanks, Dennis. And I have a feeling you're going to be a guest here rather shortly again. So we'll continue the conversation then. But thanks, everybody, for joining us, and until next time.